definition of deterrence is, we're talking about nuclear deterrence now between superpowers, Soviet Union and the United States. If each side has enough weapons to annihilate the other, and neither could destroy all the other's weapons in a first strike, then neither side will dare start a war. And that's our basic presupposition, that nuclear war can be prevented today because we have this balance of terror, this the deterrence factor, which has been in effect since the atomic weapons came out in 1945, and it's worked very successfully up to the present time. We have not we've not had a war besides conventional weapons. There have been small wars which our countries have been involved with, but nothing that is on the scale of a nuclear war. And we believe that this balance of terror is essential because otherwise, if we, well, I don't want to get into arguments right now, but okay. well, just to say that the Soviet Union is aggressive and expansionist, and they have broken many treaties with our country over the years, and we have definite irreconcilable ideologies and interests that make it necessary for us to have this deterrence factor. And now I think I'll hand it over to somebody else to see what else I
got. Well, with respect to there hasn't been a nuclear confrontation since 45. That deterrence indeed has been effective, and you can see this from the standpoint that the relationship between the U.S. and the Soviet Union during this period of time has not been one of, you know, the fact that it hasn't occurred hasn't been because our relationships have been good. I mean, there's been both sides have been very hostile during this time to each other. We had the Cold War years, both countries very much at edge. Both countries threatening each other. And on top of that, both countries have political and philosophical principles that differ very much, so much so that you would think that it would lead to conflict. But in fact, there hasn't been conflict for four decades. So the threat of nuclear deterrence has worked.
Dave was saying that the Russians and we have been a kind of a standoff, but you called it a balance of terror time. There was, for much of the first years of the present USSR's existence, they were weak militarily. But since the time of Brezhnev, there has been a big buildup of military power in Russia. Today, our foreign policy national security advisor, Robert McFarlane, says that Moscow has a 3-to-1 advantage in highly accurate ballistic missiles, which could destroy any other nation's weapons. And it is against this kind of a buildup of military power that we have to be firm. As you know, if you want to keep an intruder out of your house, you have to let the intruder know that it is disadvantageous for him to come into that home. If he knows he can come in freely, he's just going to take advantage of that. And so in a international way, we have to defend ourselves against that kind of intrusion, that kind of threat. the Soviets have the capability of destroying the bulk of our land-based ICBMs. And in recent years, the Soviets' scope of action has even changed. At one time, they were taking over land, territory, governments close by, but their invasion of Afghanistan and their intrusion and buildup of arms in Ethiopia and in a Foster way in Angola and in South Yemen have shown us that they are interested militarily in expanding in other parts of the world too, and so we can't be competent anymore. They have a strategic parity that is really scary for us. This is not, it would be nice to be able to think that we could reduce arms, but it's just plain naivety to think that if we would give up some of our defenses that the Soviets would on their side pull back. As the editor of the U.S. News said in a recent article, it would take trust of a high order to believe that the Soviets would not secretly plunge ahead with special weaponry while the U.S. observes a voluntary moratorium. At the present time, the Soviets have a significant lead in earth-based missiles. We have some superiority if we would be able to take advantage of it in outer space and our technology and understanding there. Our chief negotiator now in the discussions between the Soviets and the U.S. was at one time a pacifist. In World War I, he was a pacifist who even entered into experiments on starvation. And he has had, in the 1950s, or had a change of heart and came to the recognition that it's peace through force that we can maintain. And it is on this basis that he is our negotiator now, a Democrat serving a Republican president, by the way. So again, I reiterate what Kathleen and David have said, that although weapons are not a happy choice, they are a necessary choice in the face of the threat of invasion and attack.
Do you have anything?
Mm-hmm. Our time. 9.5 minutes left.
I can just say another thing. With respect to deterrence, that the thing we have to keep in mind is deterrence works because of nuclear balance. There has to be equilibrium on both sides. Both sides' threat has to be real, to be credible, for deterrence to work. And it's because of this equilibrium, this balance of nuclear power, is the reason why nuclear weapons hasn't been used, that it has created an atmosphere for stability. And it's necessary to recognize that any arms control or reductions has to be based on concrete reciprocal reciprocity on both sides, so that that equilibrium can be kept. As soon as you have a lopsided balance, if you unilaterally disarm, then you're creating an imbalance, and you lose your stability, and ultimate conflict can result.
In the last 2 minutes we have, two or three, I would bring this up for discussion. What is the future of the conflict. And, you know, I'm often concerned about the fact that we have all these nuclear weapons in existence. And to suggest that we can just dismantle all the bombs and take them out of position and never threaten to use them again, it's going to negate the fact that they exist. Seems a bit unrealistic. And so I wonder if not the argument for disarmament, especially unilateral disarmament, is an argument to return to the past before nuclear weapons were developed. And the future would be to do something with them, and not to use them necessarily, but to acknowledge the fact that we have them. We have the nuclear weapons, good. And eventually, with our technology, we are capable of producing a more feasible, a more humane, more practical, economically speaking, alternative. But until that time, nuclear weapons are a fairly successful means of preventing preventing a war, just if nothing else, a war between the Soviet Union and the United States, which would, as I think most people would agree, would be the worst war ever.
And it's an absurd belief that if we disarm, we always have the capability and we have this knowledge that we can't just put away in a buried under the ground somewhere. There's always the knowledge of how we created the atomic weapons in the first place. So we have to work within the bounds of reality and figure out what is a good way to work with the weapons and the knowledge that we have. So that's why deterrence is the way to go.
And to take off from what David was saying, that conventional weapons don't provide the deterrence that nuclear weapons do. Because with conventional weapons, there is the possibility of a victory. And deterrence has not worked in the past, that is, pre-nuclear era. Deterrence frequently has broken down. But since existence of nuclear weapons, that has not been the case between confrontation between the U.S. and the Soviet Union. I think we can say that we are for arms reduction, but that arms reductions has to be on a mutual basis. That is, it has to be real, it has to be a deep reduction on both sides so that equilibrium can be maintained.
Okay, that's 15 minutes. Thank you. I don't know, you know, after all, disarmament.
Our side is agreed that unilateral disarmament is the way for our government to proceed, in contrast to the present policy of nuclear weapons used for deterrence. As Christians, at present, we take into consideration holy, the just war theory, you know, go through the tenets. War must be a last resort. Everything must have been tried for negotiation and arbitration. It has to be a just cause, and I ask you, who says it is a just cause? Both sides always declare, God is for us. And third, it must be declared for it, there must be a reasonable prospect for victory. If in the case of nuclear weapons, one side's weapons trigger the other side's and everything is wiped out, or most of it, what is left. During a war, it should be proportionate to the end, or the means should be proportionate to the end, for the final good of all. And six, the non-combatants should be protected. And I think of my life, especially in Vietnam, and the use that was made of all kinds of things against common people. And after, the defeated ones should be shown mercy, including rebuilding. Who is going to rebuild? As Christians, we cannot even use the threat of using nuclear weapons.
Okay.
You're next.
There's a myth that's been perpetuated by our society that military spending creates jobs and stimulates the economy. The real facts are that military spending costs us jobs, is a misuse of our tax money, causes inflation, and the disadvantages far outweigh, or the benefits far outweigh the disadvantages of the continued nuclear arms buildup. In terms of jobs, military spending creates fewer jobs per $1 billion spent of government money, except for the space program. For $1 billion of government money, we could, let's see, the average number of jobs per $1 billion of demand gives only 78,000 jobs in the military. In terms of machinery, like farm, metalworking, and general industry, that would create, $1 billion would create 86,000 jobs. In terms of transportation, it would give us 92,000 jobs. Construction, $1 billion could create 100,000 jobs. And in the personal consumption and services, it could create 112,000 jobs. In the sector of health, including hospitals and instruments and services, could create 139,000 jobs. And in terms of education, $1 billion creates 187,000 jobs. And I will restate that the military only provide 76,000 jobs per $1 billion spent of government money. The job training programs have been sacrificed in budget cuts while military spending increases. And this disproportionately affects people of color and women since they comprise the largest number of working poor and unemployed. The tax money used to support the Pentagon was 47% in 1981. And the tax money spent for military research diverts money away from scientific research on our current problems, such as the energy crisis. Roads, ports, bridges, railways, and sewer systems continue to deteriorate due to federal budget cuts, while military spending increases. In terms of inflation, the military spends money, but it does not introduce an equal level of goods and services into our economy. Competition between military and civilian production for raw materials and machinery raises prices. The rate of productivity of our country declines as the military drains the market of capital and resources. The Selected Acquisitions Report, made by the Department of Defense of March 1980, showed that the cost of 49 major weapon systems nearly doubled over the lifetime of the projects. There's a massive misuse of funds by the military. Less than 10% of the dollar value of military contracts are awarded on the basis of competitive bidding. And military spending is partially paid for by deficit financing. The current deficit is $215 billion. The benefits of the nuclear weapons freeze, as I mentioned before, far outweigh the disadvantages. Tax money spent could be spent on programs to support our nation, such as hunger relief, shelter for the homeless, national health care for all, and this would give us real security. Another benefit would that the freeze would free us to provide economic assistance on an international level as well. Decrease in military funding for arms race would provide $200 billion over the next decade. And that is from a chart that if we were to stop spending on a new round of nuclear weapons and to stop the production of the present weapons, we would save over $200 billion. And this would be adequate to put us in the black in terms of the deficit. And last but not least, the freeze would divert tax dollars away from military defense to a civil defense. And we would be able to research and perfect other ways of negotiating and our conflicts, such as nonviolent resistance.
Okay. My understanding of deterrence is that we have two countries, the U.S. and the Soviet Union, and we are building up our nuclear arms, and we have pretty much of a balance, and we're trying to scare each other from starting a war. But that is not the case any longer. We have other countries in this world, about 30 or 40 other countries that have the capability of using or building up nuclear arms. And it really scares me to think that we have missiles and bombs planted all over Europe in many countries that have very unstable governments. And I really question what would prevent someone or some terrorist group or some government group to come in and take one of those bombs, just to come in and take it, because if my sources are reliable, our missiles are not guarded very well at all, and many times they're guarded by foreign troops. And it would really scare me to think that another government could come in and take even one of our missiles and use it as blackmail. Or worse yet, what if another government or a terrorist group would take a bomb and smuggle it into the U.S.? That would not be difficult to do, and detonate it. We would not have any way of knowing that it was the Soviet Union. We cannot assume that because so many countries and so many organizations have that capability. That's what really scares me. There's also the idea of accidental misuse or human fallibility. We are human, and under mental stress, what would prevent an accidental disaster mm-hmm. or technological fallibility? I am not convinced at all that our technology is so infallible that a mistake could not occur, and that would be just devastating. And with these arguments, I
I'm convinced that we have to have a different policy. Every arms race in the past that has gone on has resulted in war. And it just seems insane to think that it will not result in war. And if it does result in war, Lord have mercy, that's all I can say.
We've shown that reliance on military defense is a very poor defense, both from a moral standpoint and in terms of economic expediency. And in the present state, more nuclear weapons mean not more security, but less security. Now, if these arguments are valid, and we believe they are, then it's really, I guess we would say in slang terms, the height of stupidity to continue on with such a policy that we have at the present time of counting on our military nuclear might as being a deterrent. We believe that there is a better way, that unilateral disarmament is that better way. Now, there would be many different approaches possible to that. First of all, it would require a change in the entire outlook and attitude of not only our government, but of the people of the U.S. And it would, of course, have to be a gradual kind of thing to adjust economically, to plan new policies, and so on. And there would have to be definite plans for using the resources that would be saved by not using them to build up military weapons, as I think Karen had referred to, organizing civil defense first, providing international assistance and development as well as national assistance and development. It's true there are difficulties, there are dangers in this. There is the danger of it not working. But we believe that danger is much less than it is in our present policy of military deterrence. Invasion by USSR would not be likely. There would just be, in one sense, it would be a deterrent of its own. If you can imagine another country literally believing that the U.S. was going to disarm themselves, there would be so much astonishment and so much disbelief that they would probably even conclude that secretly we were doing something even more astounding and more destructive and so on, and they would not dare to take a chance that we had something hidden. In that sense, would almost be a deterrent. But hopefully, even more than that, if this could be tied to economic assistance, and if it could be seen that all this massive money and effort and manpower that had gone into preparing to wage war was instead going into preparing for helping and providing peace, then what would another country gain by an invasion? Could they not gain much more by having it in that way? And so while there's risk involved, and while it would include a real leap of faith, both in humanity and in God, that's what we believe our life in Christ is all about, believing and risking a leap of faith. And while there would be risks and possible dangers, the advantages we believe would outgain them. Unilateral disarmament would not make us dependent upon reciprocal agreement by another, which may take years and years and years and years, or as we fear, may never come before the dangers would overcome and there would be a disaster. And certainly it would gain international respect and prestige. It would be a great statement of peace on the part of the United States to disarm. And a secondary factor, it would even be seen that the U.S. would have a tremendous economic advantage, which would also lead other countries, would certainly create pressure for others to disarm, which of course would be the ultimate hope. It gives more hope, we believe, than depending on military might. Any cuts that are made at this present time and the present state of our technology certainly give more hope than depending on them. And finally, we believe that our actions must be different. If we have faith in God and we put our trust in Him and count on living according to his will and his way, then our actions must be different than those who don't. Many Christians in America make a big, great thing about the atheistic communists, and yet we, as they, threaten them with death. We, as they, continue to use our manpower and our womanpower, our money and our skills to someday be ready to use them to kill and to take human life. How then are we any different from they? Does it not make a difference that I am a Christian?
Okay, let's I'll give 7 minutes for each side to rebut.
I have some questions for Linda. We're not talking about a just war as we envisage this buildup of this. We're trying to avoid that kind of a war. We don't have to determine if there is a war. To ask Kathleen what you say to those who have lived through the Depression and who know that in World War II, the military buildup and rearmament was what saved us from the results of the Depression and brought us back to an economy that people could afford a style of life again that they had lost during the Depression. Melanie, if we disarm, how would that keep these other nations that you talk about, not just Russia, but the other nations, how would that protect us from the attacks of those others? Maybe if we disarm, the Soviets would also see that. But what about these little minor nations that have nuclear arms? How do we defend ourselves against those surprise attacks if we don't have something that is a deterrent, that would thwart the defensive weapons, that would destroy their missiles as they approach us? And finally, for all your idealism, Carolyn, this is not a Christian nation. We all know that. And your idealism is wonderful, but just not practical. And what are we going to do when we are a minority in a country? Don't we have to be realistic, and don't we have to live with the reality of what's possible rather than the idealism of what we few Christians would like to have?
I'm not sure, Karen, you were talking about the freeze, and it seems like what's your policy over there? I'm not sure if all you agree that you want to unilaterally disarm or what. Talking about the blackmail, now, Melanie, it almost seems like, see, we could be blackmailed, and that's why it is better that that we have our deterrence policy, because this is a, once we disarm unilaterally, we're just kind of an open invitation for us to be destroyed by the nations, and we could be a puppet for any other nation. And so that's why this threat is for a check against these blackmail purposes. We do not want to become vulnerable and just lay down our arms and have other countries and their communist ideologies infiltrating this country. And we ultimately want peace on Earth, but it's not contradictory that we have this deterrence policy and still want peace. That's not it at all. And to disarm wouldn't be a mutual thing, and so we have to learn to live within these limits of reality. Get real.
I think I can respond to what Karen said about jobs. I don't think that we deny that the military, for dollars spent, that there might be more jobs created outside of the military, but we recognize that maintaining stability and maintaining the peace doesn't come cheap. I mean, there's a cost we have to pay to maintain equilibrium in this military situation between the U.S. and the Soviet Union. To unilaterally disarm would put Soviets in a position of not creating, maintaining the balance of the equilibrium, nuclear equilibrium, and they'd take advantage of that. They already are taking advantage of it in Western Europe. The movements, as soon as one side gets an advantage, being seemingly more capable, threatening than the other side, then it's the very countries in which it's happening in Western Europe then tend to lean towards that side which has the most strength. And so much of our problem in Western Europe isn't coming from that. There is this feeling that the Soviet Union's now they're in fact support themselves, that their deterrent force, their nuclear force in Europe is much stronger than NATO or the West. And I think to unilaterally disarm would shift, of course, a lot of our economy. Our economy in the U.S. would strengthen itself. That very fact of strengthening our economy would be a threat to the Soviet's economy. And if that would be the case, then it would probably use military force in order to erect their economic problems and their system that they would have.
10 seconds left. Okay, response.
Okay, in terms of the balance that exists, America and the whole world tries so hard to prevent terrorist tactics and motives. We believe that the balance of terror is just that, it's a motive that we are aligning ourselves with terrorists if we believe that a balance of terror is going to work. Another aspect of the balance of a real threat that David mentioned, if the nuclear Holocaust is such a terrible thing that no one wants to be responsible for pushing that button, then it's an empty threat. In terms of the USSR being expansionist and having their money and their arms in Afghanistan, Ethiopia, Angola, and South Yemen, I maintain that the United States has their own fingers in other pots, such as El Salvador, and we don't hesitate to make our military might known. And we did that just recently with the example of Grenada. The United States as well refuses to have any other system of government besides democracy at its borders. And Moscow is the same in terms of Afghanistan. You mentioned the USSR's military, or I should say nuclear weapon, advantage over us in terms of the whole picture of nuclear weapons. There was no mention of the United States air and submarine superiority over the USSR. The United States has never been inferior to Soviets in terms of the arms race, so how would we know how they would react? And I guess my last statement would be that it was mentioned that we would be naive to think that giving up our defenses is a is a good thing to do. I maintain that it's naive to believe that the Soviets would attempt overthrowing the United States when they have a hard enough time keeping up their arms race, their side of it, and keeping their arms in these little countries around the world. Their economy is in hard enough shape without having to govern the United States also. And I truly believe that the amount of resistance that would come about, even if the Soviets did overthrow us, the amount of resistance would render it impossible for us to become communist.
I think that both Kathleen and David made a big point of the fact that deterrence has worked and deterrence will continue to work. But we dispute the last half of that statement. We feel that the arms race is now past the point where deterrence is likely to continue to work, because where is the arms race ever going to stop? It's a monster that even the military can no longer control. And so if we continue to depend on it for deterrence, that's going to mean a continuing race, a continuing battle to keep, we say even, but it has been proven that any time one side begins to get even with the other one tries to immediately get something that's going to counterattack that again and would make it possible to have a first strike advantage. And so we therefore believe that idealism is also the most practical thing now, that deterrence is an outmoded policy that cannot be expected to continue to work, that the risks with it are greater than the risks of unilateral disarmament. If perhaps we did not stress enough either that if we no longer were spending all our forces on military defense and weaponry, then there could be a concentrated effort to make possible a truly effective nonviolent resistance and defense, even if there was force used against our country.
June, eventually, just because there has been no war, somebody's going to want to try out one of those things, and then it'll be all over. And we as Christians have a duty to ourselves and to other Christians to stand for what we believe in. And our influence will probably go around the world.
I've been thinking about, June, your idea about the health and protecting your health. And then you said something about our nation is not Christian, but go for it anyway. we maintain that we're protecting our nation like we protect our house. We would get rid of the threat if we opened up our nation as we opened up our house to hospitality. I've been playing with an idea that a professor of mine suggested. What if the Soviet Union just got bombarded with a whole bunch of college students wanting to travel and study in the USSR? What if we wanted to go there to learn about the people and to learn the language and to study there? I think that would really open up things as far as changing attitudes and maintaining peace that might be even more expensive than nuclear deterrence. Maybe not. I don't know the figures for that. But I think that makes more sense than hating each other. I saw a film last night on Ireland, and they had a program like that. They sent a group of Protestant and Catholic Irish 12-year-olds over to the United States, and that really changed attitudes in those children. I think that might be a good idea.
Okay, that's time. Thank you. A lot of work in that. Any responses from anybody?
I felt so sorry for your response.
I just wanted to add one thing. Is that I just realized that in our whole presentation we totally ignored that the concept of deterrence is negated by the deployment of first strike weapons. That's a big deal.
Too late now.
Yeah. Well, we can talk about it.
As far as, you know, as I took notes just for the fun. I haven't done this for a long, long time. But they won the debate. You know, from the standpoint of a debate style, this side backed up their facts. They had a great rebuttal. June, you were, yeah. I all of a sudden I thought, you know, I was sitting here listening to this side and saying, we're not a Christian nation. Who mentioned a just war theory in the first place? And then Melanie's argument about them, and you picked up on all of those and shot them back. And they didn't respond at all.
Because that debate logic doesn't actually.
That's right. And deterrence is really, you know, you had the burden of proof. They didn't. And you blew it.
That's why you never lose, you never gain the arguments when you speak to someone who is the opposite of us.
I would just ask, where did you get your resources? You know, where were your statistics coming from? You had a chart, but you didn't tell us what it was.
Yeah,
you know, I mean, those kinds of. I just want to share that. Wise. As far as the debate style,
but
actually,
this is exactly what
debate.
I am. Why I fear to go out into the world and espouse the thing, because they say, "Where do you come from?" And I'm not smart enough to be able to back up these things and present them convincingly enough.
That's
I mean, you really have to be.
Well, I don't think it's a question of intelligence. I think it is a question of being well-read or having that, but also I don't think it's an argument that you can win with facts. That's my sense. I mean, I'm on this side, but this side won, you know, as far as the debate is concerned. I don't think you can debate the issue. I don't think there's anything to debate. From a Christian standpoint. That's...
Well, then what do you do? Because by far the majority of Christians in this country are in favor of deterrence.
Let's hear another opinion here.
Okay.
My personal standpoint is more from a deterrent viewpoint for a lot of the reasons that were given. It's one thing that I agree with from what was said over here is that the well, first of all, I don't think the issue is whether anyone really is against peace. I think it's a mistake or a miscalculation to say that people who believe in deterrence don't want peace, because ultimately that's the whole point of it. The deterrence factor is there to prevent a war. I guess, personally, I'd love to see a time come where there weren't any nuclear weapons, but that's not the way it is. And to see a unilateral disarmament from the United States side would, I don't necessarily think that we'd be overrun with Russians immediately or anything like that. However, the blackmail factor would be a big thing, because anything that they wanted to do, they could say, okay, you know, or any time that the country decided to make a stand against what the policy would be of a country who still had the nuclear weapons, it would be like a cat and mouse game. They'd let you play until you started to bother them some. And they'd say, okay, now you're going to do it our way because we can just wipe you out if we want to. They would never have to use it either. I think unilateral disarmament on the United States side would bring a kind of peace. I don't think there ever would be a nuclear weapon use after that, because it wouldn't have to be. It would be puppets dancing on a string.
So are you saying that unilateral disarmament probably isn't such a bad idea?
No, I'm saying that I don't think that the trade-off is worth it right now to lose the freedom that we have. The freedom that we have to do or act as a sovereign nation, I don't think that the trade-off for disarming unilaterally at this point would be good. Eventually, I think, and I hope that something can come about where there are no more nuclear weapons. But I don't think that, I think if there was going to be that kind of thing, it would have to be an extremely careful thing that would be completely or nearly completely verifiable. And I don't think, given human nature and things like that, that that would really work. At least right now, where someone has an advantage, you're going to want to keep it. And also, given the ideology or the stated goals of the Soviet Union, if they can influence the rest of the world to their viewpoint, then they're going to do it. That's always been their stated goal. And deterrence has worked. That's the other thing. And I think it's important to recognize that. Deterrence doesn't necessarily mean an arms escalation either.
But that's what it is.
That's what happens. That's the result.
But it's also true that we do, at this point, have a much smaller nuclear capability, at least in terms of the number of warheads and things, than we did 15, 20 years ago.
That's not true.
Yes, it is.
Could I?
Thank you.
Dan's the expert.
Oh.
Yeah.
Well, I don't
where
think it works.
Where did you get that statement? I was just reading it up above there. I think it was, I can't remember which magazine, but the accuracy of the weapons has increased. The actual number has decreased.
I don't know if it's worth getting it, but I really would encourage you to check that.
I keep thinking that whoever would think that, like 2,000 years ago, Christ coming and say, love your enemies, would make such a difference throughout the whole world. Granted, it's taken 2,000 years to make this many Christians, as many as there are in worldwide, but it shows in other ways also, not just in who are Christians, that we've had an influence all these years.
Dan, did you want
to? Yeah, I don't think I've met you personally.
Ken,
yeah, I'm Dan. Yeah, I'm just curious if you're a Christian,
mm-hmm.
Yeah, and how your faith in Jesus Christ matches what you just said. I mean, or how you've struggled with that.
Do I reconcile it?
Or how you struggle with that.
Well, okay. I don't see an irreconcilable difference between the two. And most of the other people are probably aware here that I spent 6 years in the Navy.
Mm-hmm.
And so my viewpoint is going to be colored, I'm sure.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think that there is an irreconcilable difference between the two. I'm not completely settled in my own mind.
Mm-hmm.
But at this point, I would not be able to support a unilateral disarmament position. Maybe that'll change, I don't know. But I don't really see it as being too realistic. You probably know a lot more than, you know, everyone here has probably thought it out a lot more than from the other side than I have. But I want to learn that too.
Yeah, I'm just saying it's a struggle.
Mm-hmm. It's not a clarification in my mind.
How many?
Well, in the debate, I noticed a difference from the standpoint that your side, you know, bringing up Christian principles and moral backup for your position, whereas deterrence, I mean, we sort of avoid that. We didn't talk about our value structures or moral positions at all.
But that's good debate policy, too.
That's right.
Absolutely. Yeah. In the stay debate, you don't give your own.
But I mean, in terms of what June says.
But if you're just talking about now and again how we approach it.
I think we find ourselves trying to argue against deterrence and then and try to match them on their stage or in their in the ball field, however you want to say it, on their home turf. Mm-hmm. And we can't do that.
That's right.
I mean, it doesn't make sense. So we feel defensive, and so then we try to match them at base where they're coming from, and this doesn't work.
That's why Susan said you can't debate it.
Right.
But I'm interested, Bill, will we get into more tomorrow then? How do we deal, I guess we'll go tomorrow, deal with presenting to others so we can hold off on that.
I'd like to take just a minute to hear reactions to that article in Sider's book, or the section on civilian-based defense. And you can argue both sides of every one of these, I think, except for the last one. And some people would argue a lot. First is that it takes into account means and ends. A.J. Mustey has said there is no way to peace. Peace is the way. Gandhi, Martin Luther King, many, many other people have said you simply cannot get to peace and justice through violence. That even a defensive war, as it's popularly thought of, World War II, that we're still today paying the price for that, as far as use of violence. Often arguments about deterrence bring up the fact of original sin, and that, which is, as we talked about in Matthew Fox, a really somewhat biblically, it's not quite the way we've often understood it from our theologians, but that the problem is people are just not good people, so we need these weapons to defend ourselves. I would make two arguments about that. The first is because sin is so prevalent, we dare not have these weapons because we'll use them. And I don't know, you know, immediately how to get rid of them. But when I look at original sin, I come to exactly the opposite conclusion that the deterrence people do. Because of original sin, we don't dare have these babies around. And also, original righteousness at the same time, which is also a Christian tenet. We're created in the image of God. And if this weren't true, we wouldn't have to train troops to be mean and to kill, and you know, the whole desensitization, dehumanizing experience that all military people are you know, put through to make them better military people. Okay, following that? If, you know, if there weren't this sense of original righteousness inside people, you know, we wouldn't have to do that. It allows, civilian-based defense allows participation by the whole society rather than just our 18, 19, 20-year-old males. As Karen brought out and is getting some, finally, the Rotary Society, more publicity economically. I mean, the arms race is an absolute economic disaster. I mean, World War II brought us out of the Depression, but it wasn't because it was military spending, it's because it was government spending. Could have been spent on hospitals, bridges, and anything like that. That wouldn't have to be military spending. Okay.
I have a question. Mm-hmm. What's the difference between military and government spending? Our military is government spending.
Right, but I'm saying the argument is always military spending brought us out of World War II.
Out
of the Depression.
Government spending, which was a good part of which was military,
right.
Brought us out.
Wouldn't have had to have been military, though.
It wouldn't have had to have been, but the argument, right, but the argument is not. I mean, what I'm hearing is that there's a difference between the two, and there really isn't.
No, there isn't. What I'm saying is.
It could have been other forms of government
spending.
Yeah,
it was government spending. It wasn't necessary military spending.
It was government spending on the military. It could have been government spending on other things,
else.
Right? But I don't want to hear the distinction between. I mean, I'm uncomfortable hearing the distinction between military and government.
No, I don't. I wasn't trying to. Well, I guess I was trying to make the distinction. That people will say military spending brought us out, and I want to say it was government spending
on
happened to be on military. Could have been on anything. I don't know. Maybe we're just imaginary. Okay. One of the articles in that I put on reserve, I can't, and I just put it on a few days ago, so probably not many of you saw it, but that it's an interesting article about the use and presence of nuclear weapons is against international law, and that the Nuremberg trials brought out that any citizens who do not actively, you know, go against national laws that are breaking international law can be held liable. And it's an interesting article used by by some civil disobedient people, saying that international law requires me to break U.S. law and demonstrate against these missiles, or I'll be guilty, and it just as the Nuremberg people were. It's an interesting article and fairly compelling. Again, not everybody would buy it. This is related to this one, I suppose. Taking into account the moral force or true power. Mulford Q. Sibley's article about the case for unilateral disarmament now. Is that what it's called? Something like that. Makes a good argument, I think, that who knows what would be the effect if the United States would in fact unilaterally disarm and could convince the world that we didn't have a secret weapon. I thought that was an interesting article or argument, Carolyn, and one I'd never thought of before, that no one would dare try anything because they'd think we had something up our sleeve. I never thought of it, but that's worth some more thought. But you know, we talk about international publicity and what people think. That's why Amnesty International works. It doesn't always work, but the what the international community thinks about a country, and I would argue, or I think at least Gandhi would argue, that it would be very difficult to get anyone to invade the United States if we were no threat. Then again, you could look at Norway to get invaded in World War II, and they weren't afraid of it. So. Accidents. It's well documented that in a recent 6-month period at the Pentagon there were 151 false alarms with their nuclear weapons system. And one of them that's celebrated accident was computer operator put in a practice tape into the computer of a nuclear attack, and the computer read it as a real nuclear attack, and we scrambled our B-52s and everything, and were within some say 6 minutes of sending them off to the Soviet Union. You know, 151 false alarms. I mean, we're getting now to the point of computer-operated systems with humans not even involved. And if you ever worked with computers or ever gotten a wrong, you know, bill from a department store or been told that you're dead by the Social Security or, you know, things like that, that's got to make you pretty nervous. I go back here to this one. And we have about 100 to 105,000 people in the United States that have nuclear weapons security clearances. That has, you know, something to do with nuclear weapons. About between 100 and 105,000. And there's a Newsweek article about a year and a half ago that showed that each year between 3 and 5,000 of these people are removed because of alcoholism, mental illness, insubordination, criminal arrest, things like this. You know, 3 to 5% of our people, again, this one, back to this one again, of the people that currently have nuclear weapons security clearances. That's really scary.